This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is Sterling Allen, your host. You can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. And today we have an hour-long interview with Ken Round. Ken is our science advisor at PES Network and also a founding member at the New Energy Congress. He's been involved in alternative energy, cutting-edge energy technologies for many years. And Ken is going to be talking to us today about the Joseph Papp Noble Gas Engine. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So you've been involved in the Papp engine. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved, and we're going to be exploring just what that Papp engine is. Maybe you can give us a brief introduction as to what the engine is, what it does, and how you got involved.
All right. I was a research scientist with Gene Maloff at the New Energy Research Laboratory in New Hampshire several years ago. And a fellow by the name of Heinz Klosterman approached us to tell us about his detective work on the work of Joseph Papp and his noble gas engine. So that's how I heard about it and how Heinz met me. After I left the research lab for a lack of funds, when the lab ran out of funding, Heinz Klosterman came up with funding to work on the Papp engine and called me out to the West Coast, to the San Francisco area where he is, and he started a company there where I was the first employee as a hands-on scientist to rebuild the Papp engine. And the engine of Joseph Papp is a piston engine like the type that is found in automobiles, but it has no intake, no exhaust, and no fuel. It has a sealed charge of noble gas mixtures in it, like helium, neon, argon, xenon, krypton, sealed inside the piston cylinders, and an electric discharge, not all that dissimilar from a neon strobe lamp, like a camera flash, takes place inside the cylinder, and with this much larger electric discharge, it creates a very large energy release from an otherwise unknown energy source that gives enough power to push the pistons and run the engine in as a high-power piston engine.
So where's the energy coming from if there's no combustion going on?
Well, Joseph Papp claimed that it was a nuclear reaction taking place in the gases, but the science doesn't mesh with what we know at this point, and there's no evidence to date that there was any nuclear reaction taking place in the gases. So it's all back to square one from the point of view of the science behind it. But the history of just the facts that the engine ran, no question about it that it's real.
How long did it run in its longest, in one setting?
At a single time, it probably ran for a couple of days, although they didn't run it with any very long-term testing. It was just tinkering around with it. But one engine under the same operating conditions would be turned on periodically and run for hours or days for a couple of years. That was the extent of the longevity testing that was done on it.
And there was no emission. There's nothing coming out. There's no tailpipe.
Oh, no. It's an entirely a sealed engine.
And there's what about heat? Is it generating heat?
There's some heat, but nowhere near as much as a typical internal combustion engine. What Joseph Papp built and tested for a long time was a two-cylinder engine that was dynamometer tested to produce over 100 horsepower. And when that was running at 100 horsepower, it would get hot, but not so hot that you couldn't put your hand on it and hold it there for a few seconds. Maybe 150 degrees Fahrenheit was the block temperature.
The average car running down the road, how many horsepower?
If it's really being pushed for all it's worth, it's a little over 100 horsepower. So these are comparable power ranges.
What about size? How big was that engine that was putting out 100 horsepower?
No, it's about the same size as, four-cylinder, typical small-size four-cylinder engine.
And would a typical four-size cylinder engine put out 100 horsepower on a
no.
high range?
No, the typical engine is a bigger mid-size car engine, like a V6, which would be in the 100 to 150 horsepower range.
So even in prototype stage, this thing putting out 100 horsepower was smaller than an internal combustion engine, yet it was consuming no fuel.
That's right. And besides that, it was only spinning at 1,000 RPM, which is idle or below for most internal combustion engines. It was a very high torque engine, like 700 foot-pounds.
Now, I saw a Sebori video one time, and it
yes.
was showing like 30 RPMs with tremendous torque.
Yes, it can run below 50 RPM and not stall.
So, were you able to actually see a working prototype yourself?
No, that was prior to my arrival on the scene. The last running engine was still under the auspices of Joseph Papp, who died of cancer in 1989, and none of his engines have run since then. He took some of his secrets to the grave and did not tell the people who worked with him everything about the engine.
So the job right now is to try and reconstruct what he had accomplished.
Exactly, but for the first time with a good team of seasoned and experienced engineers and scientists. Prior to this, it was just mechanics, businessmen, and farmers who worked with him.
So is there a group besides Heinz Klosterman who is involved?
Yes, you mentioned Jimmy Sebori, and he's still working on his own, but his brother Jake has a trio going on in San Jose called Infinite Horizons, along with two other men. And then there's a lone researcher named Mark Hugo in Minneapolis who's been reconstructing the firings of the PAP engine. Mark Hugo does not have an engine, but he's been testing the firings in a test bench arrangement and has been getting positive results. So that's most of the active people involved in it right now.
Jimmy Sebori, he was in the video that I saw, and they had working stuff then. What was that?
That was mostly photographs from the days of when Jimmy Sebori was actually an investor with Joseph Papp in the last year or two of his life. And that's when Jimmy Sebori and Jake, to an extent, were working for Joseph Papp. And then after that, Jimmy Sebori worked a little bit on his own, and he did have some firings of the engines, but his engine versions never actually ran. They would kick over once or twice, and that was it. So that's all that Jimmy has to show.
There were three. What's the patent story on the technology?
I'm sorry, Sterling, your voice is fading.
I was asking how many patents there are on the technology.
Oh, okay. Joseph Papp has three patents on the technology, and Jimmy Sebori has one that is based out of Australia and is virtually a carbon copy of the third Papp engine patent, and I don't know how Sebori got that one through.
Okay. At the time that Joseph Papp was alive, he had working technology. You were saying in your overview that he had somewhat of a paranoid personality.
Oh, yes.
And would you say that that was a primary contributor to why it did not go further?
That's complicated. I'll say yes and no. It's much larger than just his personal paranoia. That was part of it, because he was the boy with the goose that lays the golden eggs, and everybody was after that goose. That's part of his paranoia. He wanted to protect it so it wouldn't get stolen from him.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that there just wasn't a lot of cooperation among all of the workers, not to mention the workers just wanting to have what Papp had. So it's not just a simple case of paranoia. He was being properly protective in some ways.
So what was the primary impediment? Were there men in black trying to take him out, or was that an element?
No, it was just private interests of people just trying to shove others around for various personal gain through leveraging things various ways through business practices.
Hmm. Was there at the time a list of people of high caliber knocking on his door trying to have a piece of the action?
No. The closest that came to that was one day Richard Feynman showed up for the public demonstration of the first
Feynman?
Running tap engine.
That Tell was us again who Richard Feynman is.
I'm sorry?
Who is Richard Feynman?
Oh, he's a famous professor of physics at Caltech and a Nobel laureate in physics. I think it was 1964 or so that he won the Nobel laureate for contributing to quantum mechanics. Richard Feynman is also the scientist who figured out the Challenger space shuttle disaster. So he's very well known as a brilliant and sharp man. But he showed up one day for the public demonstration of the TAP engine, and he interfered with the operation of the engine because the electronic ignition for the engine was controlled by 120-volt power from the building. The demonstration was out in a parking lot in Los Angeles, and the controls were operated from an extension cord from the wall plug inside the building. And Feynman said, aha, this is a hoax, went over to the extension cord, pulled it out, and then yelled to the crowd that was surrounding there, says, this is a goddamn hoax. And everybody looks over at him, and the engine's still running, but the extension cord is unplugged. And Tap got very mad and stormed over to Feynman, had an argument with him, and finally just yanked the plug from him, put the plug back in the wall to stabilize the engine, which was still running, but running rough. And the engine exploded and killed somebody.
Well, that's certainly going to put a damper on things.
Oh, it sure did. But Richard Feynman couldn't justify his claim that it was a hoax, that there was an electric motor inside, or that explosives were placed in the engine so it would be deliberately destroyed so nobody could investigate the mystery any further. And because somebody died, there was a police forensics investigation, and they found no evidence of explosives. And Tap sued Feynman for interference for $1.5 million, I think it was, and Feynman and Caltech settled out of court. They didn't want this to go through the court and have a black eye on their record.
From your perspective at this point, with all that you've known, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about this from different people who are possibly even in attendance at that, do you think that Feynman was guilty I wouldn't use the word guilty, was basically being a human being and was fighting a new technology that he didn't understand and was basically in a mode of rejecting something just because it was new?
Exactly. That's a good assessment of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was being reckless about it because he didn't know how he might disturb the stability of the engine.
Mm-hmm.
He just assumed it was a total hoax, and by pulling out the plug, it would just wind down and stop in a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't.
Yeah,
it actually was running for about 3 minutes before people knew that the extension cord was pulled out.
In terms of assessing just how much energy was coming from the extension cord to make the engine run, your understanding of electronics and mechanical action, could you get 100 horsepower from an outlet?
Oh, no way. You might be able to get 3 horsepower out of it.
So Feynman, obviously, if he thought for a second, would know that.
Right, but this engine was not under load. It was just freewheeling on a test stand, but spinning at what observers said they could see, because the fan was still attached to it from the old Volvo engine that it was modified from. And they say the fan was spinning as if it were operating about 2 or 3,000 RPM. And not even an engine starter can spin it anywhere near that fast. And that's most engine starters are a half horsepower, and it's barely cranking at 100 RPM. This is running at least 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way that extension cord could have run something like a starter or an alternator in reverse to run the engine.
So it seemed that that behavior is indicative that he was in a mode of rejecting without even being open to the possibility that there might be something new here.
Oh, absolutely. It was a totally closed-minded attitude that this was a hoax, a farce.
Mm-hmm.
And not that it was something new. It was just that this was wrong. Somebody's trying to make a name for himself, and he's just totally wrong. That was Feynman's attitude.
And unfortunately, that type of scenario manifests itself over and over again in alternative energy.
It does.
Yeah. And I have to tell you that I appreciate that, you know, you come from an academic background and you kind of run a tightrope between the two worlds.
That's right.
And you see, on the one hand, people with high credentials who are somewhat open-minded, and you also hang out around a crowd who is much less academically inclined, and you run interference between the two.
Yes, that's true. I'm an outcast in both groups.
Mm-hmm. An outcast of both groups.
That's right.
Sometimes you probably even look at with a jaundiced eye among inventors because you come from academia thinking, well,
that's what I mean. That's why I'm rejected by that group.
Mm-hmm. Right. I certainly appreciate that you hang out with us, because your input in the New Energy Congress and as our advisor at PES Network has been invaluable. I really am glad that you don't just throw up your hands and walk away from us.
Well, thanks. It's my world, too. I'm not about to give up on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were involved for several months with Heinz Klosterman, apparently not very well managed in terms of where the monies were going. There were a lot of office work type of things, building space for experimentation rather than actually spending the money on experimentation. But were you able to make any strides in pushing the science forward while working with Heinz Klosterman?
Yes. Yes, although the money problems were not so much on what the money was spent on, was just simply the money that was invested in it. The money that was promised when the corporation was formed never showed up. So we were always on a duct tape and coat hanger budget, so to speak. It was bare minimum. I don't think there was much waste. It just wasn't adequately planned with committed funds to begin with. But what we did do for the 10 months that we did have funding was go through the PAP engine patents in a methodical process and look at all the different parameters, because there are many of them specified in the patents, and just seeing what works and what doesn't. We had an engine built by the last mechanic who worked with Joseph Papp approximately the last 10 years of his life, and that was Bob Rohner from West Liberty, Iowa. And Bob Rohner built an engine of virtually identical condition as the last ones that actually ran for Papp. And we had that to play with. And we put gases in it and tried all sorts of ignition controls, if you want to think of it in terms of igniting the gases, but it's really just an electric discharge. And all we managed to do was rule out what didn't work, but it was actually very productive because it narrowed the list of what the important parameters were.
Now, in terms of helping science move forward, you obviously, oftentimes what doesn't work can be as helpful as showing what does work. So
that's
there are
right.
Other people who come along and want to also experiment on this can go through a list of here's some things that we tried that didn't work and here are our lab notes. Is that something that you think Congressman would be willing to make available to other researchers?
Unfortunately, all this information is tied up within a corporate structure right now that does not want to divulge this information to the public.
Mm-hmm.
It's business as usual.
So Heinz Clostermann is still wanting to pursue this and is still waiting for the funding.
Yes, there are at least two potential funding parties that are negotiating right now with the owners of Clean Energy Incorporated, Heinz Clostermann's corporation. And once the funding comes along, then we'll be able to hire me and several other scientists back to work on it full time.
Mm-hmm. You did a review about a month ago on what amounts to the top five energy technologies as you see it. If I remember right, this was not one of the technologies.
No, that's true. I would rate TAP as number six.
Okay.
I didn't want to just put everything in there that I think is viable, but just give a smattering of the best ones there. One reason I did not put the PAP engine on that list is that there's so much infighting with the technology, the intellectual property, and not enough cooperation with the people to get it going that I don't give it as much confidence as some of the other ones that I placed as the top five.
So the politics of science were a downsider here more than the science itself?
Oh, yeah, I'd say so. Although the science itself, the science and technology itself is still an incomplete story. It still has a significant amount of risk involved in going forward with that.
And that wouldn't be the case if Joseph Papp was still alive and we still had his information. So the part of the risk is, can we actually replicate what he accomplished?
Exactly. It's not a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think it's probably at about the 90% probability that it will succeed if the right funding is put to it,
mm-hmm.
which is several million dollars.
Well,
this
I would
is not
think
a tiny project to take on.
I would think that there would be somewhat of a religious element. Maybe religious is the right word, a faith element. I personally believe that ideas and inventions don't necessarily originate in the mind, but are put there by maybe an angelic or some other force, departed spirits, whatever you want to call it, who mm-hmm. are working on technologies and are working, interfacing with the human race and have the ability to plant ideas in the minds of men. I would think that this technology, as valuable as it could be for solving the energy crisis of mankind, that if somebody were in the proper mindset, that the answers would come, and that the politics of science are counteractive to those types of forces.
I generally agree with that.
Mm-hmm. So if someone were, if had some money that they wanted to put into clean energy, you would say that this is a fairly good place for them to consider. Number one, there's already been existing prototypes that were witnessed by many people, including
mm-hmm.
scientifically minded people, and so it's not like an unproven concept.
And actually the technical staff that have been identified for this project can work with each other quite well, but it's mostly management and financial interests that are complicating things right now.
Let's say
the money just simply came in and that was all ironed out, then it'd be smooth sailing from there with a technical team.
Mm-hmm. Let's say, for example, that you got the money and you were able to get this thing to work again. Would there be some... Who owns the rights to the patents, and would they be stepping forward saying, hold on a second, you need to go through us?
Well, the three PAP patents have expired, and I'm not even certain that they're valid to begin with, because if they weren't a complete disclosure, then they would be invalid. And we're not even sure that they're a complete disclosure yet. Other than that, I'm not aware of any intellectual property that could shut down the development from a number of different points of view if the PAP engine were shown to work. Other people, if the original patents were valid, then other people would be able to enter the business too.
So it's basically first, whoever gets there first.
Well, even beyond that, if it actually is just a true replication, there's nothing else that can be patented over to exclude anybody. But most likely, if somebody does make it work, they will find some aspect of it that is patentable, and then that whole issue comes up.
Okay, let's say, and this is now conjecture, because obviously you still haven't figured out how PAP did it.
That's right.
But from what you know of what he said, how scalable is this technology, small and big?
It will not scale down very small and can go a little ways bigger, but not a whole lot. It really is somewhat size-specific for the generation of the plasma inside of it, as far as I know. There's no way you'll get something small enough to operate your cell phone or your laptop computer, but there's a good possibility it could get big enough to run a railroad locomotive or an airplane.
So that one of these could run a 747?
Yes, or several of them could run a 747.
Mm-hmm.
Just literally replace the jet engines with one PAP engine.
Mm-hmm.
The power density is that high.
What about, let's say, a ship?
Yeah, that would have to be done, well, I can't say it would have to be done, but most likely it would be modular.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that it won't get, that these engines will not get up beyond, the 100,000 horsepower range. 10,000 horsepower range, like the railroad locomotives.
Mm-hmm. So two orders of magnitude above the 100 horsepower that he achieved.
At most, yes. Maybe even less.
What about how much smaller? Could you go as small as 10 horsepower?
No, not as a maximum output. I suspect you won't be able to run a motorcycle with it either. That's too small of an application.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the physics of what's going on in there, the video that I saw, there was some kind of a flash. There was there were photons being emitted in the process
mm-hmm.
of combustion. Or I say combustion, there was some kind of an explosive process going on, even though gases were not being consumed. There was some kind of there's a piston involved that's creating
right.
Force.
Well, that's the electric arc discharge that starts the whole thing. It gives off a tremendous amount of light, but it's not enough energy to move the piston. What also was shown in the Sabori tapes were some glowing red-orange particles that sort of spilled off of whatever it was and was rolling on the inside of the clear glass cylinders. And that was evidence of electrodes melting, and that's not a stable condition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the electrodes can't be touched for the PAP engine to operate more than just a couple of rotations. Obviously, if you want something that'll run continuously for a month, the electrodes can't be touched at all.
On the Sabori video that I watched, he was describing that you've got this cylinder where these explosions, for better lack of better terminology, I can't remember the word he used, but you've got this cycle taking place that is creating torque.
Yeah, it managed to push pistons occasionally to catch it on videotape, but that's as far as it went.
And he was saying that you would only have to replace one of these pistons again. maybe every year, I can't remember, it was some long period of time.
Right, yeah, about 1,000 hours is what Joseph Papp said.
Now, what's involved in that? Is that going to be maintenance prohibitive in terms of being cost effective, where you have to go?
No, not at all. It's like replacing the refrigerant in the air conditioner in your car. That's all it is. It's just simply a replacement of the gas that's put in the engine.
And how long would that take?
Oh, 5 minutes to exhaust the engine and recharge it.
And how much would the gases cost that you're putting
in? It all depends on who owns the technology. Just the gases by themselves, as they are available from gas suppliers today, it's probably $3 worth of gases.
Now,
but Joseph Papp treated the gases. And that's one thing that clean energy technology has not been able to do, because they didn't have the funding for the gas treatment process. And the work that I did in my research was not with treated gas. And scientifically, there's no way to explain the polarization that Joseph Papp claimed that the gas was undergoing. So we just eliminated that part of the process and said, well, we'll test the rest of it. Maybe it will be seen that, by golly, there is something that's going on by polarizing the gas that we just didn't know about. In that case, if that's what it is, if somebody patents that, they can hold it for a king's ransom and charge you $1,000 for a charge. Who knows? That's what the potential is.
This next question is going to be a little bit unfair, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but you talked at the beginning of this segment about three individuals or three groups that are pursuing this technology: the Jimmy Sabori and Jake Sabori group, the Mark Hugo group, and then Heinz Klosterman group that you're involved with.
Which
four of those
groups.
Three?
Jake and Jimmy are not working together.
Okay, so those are two groups. Of those groups, which do you think is the most promising?
Oh, definitely clean energy technology.
That's Klosterman?
Clean Energy Incorporated, yeah, Klosterman's group.
Okay.
The others seem to be less organized or have fewer resources to make it work.
Okay. So if somebody listening to the segment or exploring this technology wanted to put money into this, that would be, in your opinion, the best bet, not just because that's the one you're involved in. Is that why you're involved with that group?
Yes. I wouldn't be involved with something that I thought didn't have a good chance of working.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now, I don't have any vested interest in the company at this point, any substantial amount to speak of.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the process that is making this thing work. That you have a piston. Would you say that explosion is the best word to describe what's going on in the piston?
Probably, although even that's debatable within the inner circle of scientists working on this. We're all debating what really is going on. We're not sure that it's a purely thermodynamic process, although Joseph Papp claimed that it was.
Let's just talk about the significance for a second. There may be some in the audience listening to this who may not appreciate the fact that noble gases are inert, meaning that they by themselves, in normal conditions, will not combust.
Right.
Or react.
That's right.
And that's why they're called noble gases. Isn't that part of the derivation of that word?
Oh, yes. They're not perfectly inert, but they're close enough that they changed the name 30 or 40 years ago from inert gases to noble gases.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the just what we're used to, it'd be like pouring the water on a counter and lighting a match to it and it starts on fire. It's just not something we're used to seeing.
That's right.
Somehow there's a process that Joseph Papp came up with where he's able to get these noble gases to actually not only fire, but to put out a significant amount of energy and
right.
not even be consumed in the process, except maybe minusculely, so that you can replace the gas every, what did you say, 1,000 hours?
Right.
So there's something going on there that is very unusual. Now, this is maybe a off-the-wall question, but this Joseph, the Joseph technology that we've been looking at that looks really quite curious in terms of they're claiming that you take this, what amounts to an electrolytic cell, you put water in there, you charge the water magnetically, the water starts bubbling, and then you disconnect the cell, and you can allegedly run an engine on that cell that is disconnected from any power source. It is not consuming water. There's some other force going on, and an experimenter in Australia says that it's proton energy coming, is firing off the top of that cell. It goes into the engine, goes right through the engine block. There's no opening that it's going through. It's just going right through the engine block. A proton is, of course, a very small atomic structure and is not going to be impeded by the molecular structure of the engine block. Is able to go right in there and is able to combust in the engine using what amounts looks like just the air going into the engine. Is it possible that the noble gas engine is involving similar forces?
Yes,
if there's anything to
possible, but we don't have any mechanism yet that makes sense as to what could be going on. Could be some as yet uncategorized nuclear reaction that's taking place that is either catalyzed or caused by the gases when they reach many, many thousands of degrees of temperature in the electric arc ignition.
And yet there's not a lot of heat coming off of this thing.
That's right.
Now, in the day when Joseph Papp was around demonstrating this thing, he gave a few demonstrations from what I understand, and I would think that there would be included in those from the academic world who would just want to jump all over this in terms of exploring it, dissecting it, finding out how it works, what's going on. Was there that element of scientists wanting to study and go forward with this technology from an experimental point of view?
Yes, there was an interest from TRW, a military industrial contractor that actually was ready to sign a contract with PAP in 1968 at the time of the public engine demonstration. But then when the engine exploded, TRW convened a meeting of about 10 or 20 engineers who never had any exposure to the PAP engine development, and they just decided by themselves that because of the explosion, it must have been a hoax. There must have been some explosives there, and then they dropped the contract before it was signed. They literally had a contract on the site. Somebody from TRW was there the day of that demonstration, a blank contract ready to be signed, and after the explosion occurred, the signing never took place. But yes, TRW was interested, and then they lost interest because of the explosion and the death.
And yet, surely they kept track of what was going on in terms of the follow-up investigation by the FBI about the forensics and that there were no explosives discovered, and the settlement out of court.
Mm-hmm.
Was it just too much bad blood that had gone on there that they decided not to get involved in it?
That's all I could see. There also was not a very open attitude in industry or academia related to this stuff, and it was just a few individuals here and there that took it anywhere.
So it had a pariah aspect to it?
Yes.
And so the few people who were willing to buck the system and pursue it notwithstanding the pariah aspect were scared off because of the explosion and the additional politics that that introduced.
That's right. There were some other groups that showed some interest in it, but I don't know enough of the details of what transpired to describe that situation. I know that Convair in San Diego was involved, and I think that's a division of General Dynamics that makes the atomic submarines for the U.S. Navy. They showed an interest in it, but it never went anywhere. And I have no details on it, so I'm not even going to speculate what happened.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a second about if this thing were to actually be developed and start going commercial, what kind of price point would we be talking about? Let's say I wanted to buy a 100-horsepower engine that could run my pickup truck for construction.
Oh, I have a hard time putting a number on that, because I don't even know what the cost of a replacement engine is for a car.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll probably be a little bit cheaper than that, because it's actually a slightly simpler mechanism. If it's mass-produced, it will certainly be cost-competitive and maybe even cheaper.
You don't have a cooling system.
That's right.
You don't have an exhaust system. You don't have to worry about emissions. What about throttle?
Well, there's some complication to it there. The ignition control, if you want to call it that, the electric discharge control, and in that is what controls the speed of the engine. But the basic mechanical contraption is very simple. It doesn't have any valves in it, and that just simplifies it considerably.
The device that I saw on the Sabori video, and you had mentioned that Sabori had actually worked directly with PAP, and that the engine that was being shown in that video was PAP's engine, not Sabori's engine. Sabori was a financial interest at that point. That engine was governable. They were able to increase the speed, decrease the speed. They had it was hooked up to a dynamometer, and it went from like 30 RPM all the way up to 700 or something like that.
That dynamometer testing was only documented up to about 100 RPM, 110, or I don't remember exactly, but the engine, yes, could run up to almost 1,000 RPM, and maybe even faster. Now, the original engine that exploded was supposedly running about 2,000, but that was not the same engine design as the one that was put on the dynamometer testing.
So what we have here in terms of a marketing view and a practicality point of view is once the technology is perfected to the point that it can be put out into a consumer-ready product, that actually costs, for the same output, actually costs a little less than existing internal combustion engines, and the big difference is that it doesn't require any fuel.
True.
Well, that's, I would say, slightly, would be highly advantageous in terms of turning around and halting our emissions that's causing
global warming. Oh, sure, but also look at this side of it, Sterling, that it's also, as the old saying goes, it's too good to be true, and this is a classic example of it. It's just too fantastic for most people to believe it to be real.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's unfortunate. I mean, where's people's imagination? I mean, if you were to take an aborigine who's never seen modern civilization and start introducing him to some of the gadgets that we have today, everything from cell phones, cordless phones, computers, etc., they would just be flabbergasted left and right with every little gadget, everything from the toys that we have to the high-tech things that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything in modern civilization, from the refrigerator to the flushing toilet to lights, is way beyond what we were 100, 500 years ago.
Oh, right.
And so why can't people have a little imagination to realize that there are yet things that can be discovered that can move us quantum leaps forward from where we're at today?
Because our Western society has been teaching us that some things are just impossible. And it's been drummed into us for generations.
Well, it seems to me that what we have always existing in human nature is the principle articulated in the Bible, new wine can't be put into old bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And the status quo mindset resists new ideas, resists new concepts, and, you know, the revolutionary technologies are not going to come from the established institutions, come from outside the box. So we understand that why can't we just jump all over it and look, you know, keep our eyes up for it, and when it comes along, go with it?
Yeah, well, there's historically there's one thing that's to the advantage of the naysayers, that when they have said, no, this is a farce, they've been right. There have been many preceding attempts that have been farcical, that have been hoaxes, and we have that black eye to live with. You know, it's the story of the boy who cried wolf, and now nobody will listen.
Well, more than, I think it's not so much the boy who cried wolf as much as when you get outside the box, there's a lot of noise.
Sure.
And the further you get outside the box, the more noise there is. And the less polished people are, because they're just their personality
type. Oh, sure. I like to say the wider you open the window, the more dirt that flies in.
And yet, we know that out there is the most likely place for the truly revolutionary concept to come forward. The further
sure.
you get outside the box. And so, this guy had a working prototype. Of course he's got to have something plugged in, because you've got electronic controls. But you said earlier that there's no way that the outlet power that would come through that cord would be adequate to power a device that was putting out
right.
as much power as it
Bob was
putting
Rohner
out.
Was convinced that this was real when he was working with Joseph Papp, and there was a clunking noise in one of their prototypes, and they decided to take it apart and find out what was making the noise. And Papp had designed it so that the piston and cylinder could be removed as one unit and still remain hermetically sealed. So basically the piston top was unscrewed from the piston bottom and the crank linkage. And when they opened up the engine, they found, oh, gee, the oil sump is hitting on one of the cranks for one of the cylinders. So they moved the oil inlet, just bent it aside a little bit, and slipped the piston and cylinder hermetically sealed assembly back in, bolted it down, and they turned the engine on, and it ran. At that point, Bob Rohner says, I believe it. I saw that engine taken apart. I knew how it was built because I built it, and there's no monkey business in there. It just runs.
Is he still with us?
Yeah, he's part of Klosterman's team. He's
okay,
still in
so.
Iowa right now, and when we got the money, he's considering moving to San Francisco to join the rest of us over here.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. How old is he now?
He's, I'd say about 55,
good help.
60, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm. And he actually rubbed shoulders personally with...
Oh, yeah. He spent several years with Joseph Papp, and actually let him stay at his house or somebody else's house in Iowa while they were in their early days of working together. And Bob Rohner and his brothers would stay at Papp's house in Florida years afterwards when... Papp was doing most of his work out of a mansion on a lake in Florida. That seemed to be where Papp's interest was to get some money from investment so that he could live well. And then he just spent the rest of his days just tinkering on his engine, still working on it, but didn't seem to have much interest in commercializing it. He just wanted investment money, and he was happy.
That seems unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. That's just another quirky side of his personality.
Uh-huh.
He was not hell-bent on getting a new energy source for the world. He was just happy to think that he had it there, and he was just going to keep tinkering with it. He also was mad with his first business partner and said, I'm never going to let this go commercial because I hate you. He just had a spiteful personality.
Well, that's another observation I've made in my involvement in cutting-edge energy technology out the box, outside of mainstream, is that the further you get outside the box, the less refined are the personalities that are promoting the technologies, the less amenable they are, the less able they're able to interface with businessmen, with legal interests, the more pariah-ish their personalities become.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like It's a own worst enemy phenomenon.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, he's not with us anymore, so that's unfortunate on the one hand, but also the impediment of the personality is also taken out of the mix, which could be a benefit.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, where do you think this technology, in terms of applications, where do you think the best place to implement technology is going to be?
The best places will be in the most obvious locations. For mobile power plants in cars and trucks and trains, and also, believe it or not, for airplanes, and for stationary electricity generation. We already have the perfect shoe-in locations for those things.
So just basically replace out the existing elements you have to build from the ground up, or could you just replace an existing engine with this engine?
It could be replaced with an existing engine.
Ideally, of course, you would design it from the ground up.
Yeah, that's right, because the PAP engine has much higher torque ratings, too, and to get the commensurate powers, you'd have to use a different transmission gear ratio.
What about the noise that comes from this thing? Is it
comfortable? It's as quiet as a sewing machine when everything's running right. It's not silent, but it's almost, you almost don't hear anything.
Hmm. So even though there's some kind of force creating the torque, the explosion type of force or whatever is causing that is not creating a noise similar to what you have in an internal combustion engine.
Yeah, it's not the same sort of vibratory noise, percussive vibratory noise of a gasoline or a diesel engine.
What about marrying some of the new engine technologies, designs that people have come up with that are far superior to the existing internal combustion engine design, such as the gun engine
right.
You were quite interested
yes.
in.
Clean Energy Incorporated is looking into different configurations, and actually we've applied for patents of that sort. One was issued just a year ago for what Heinz Klosterman calls a flying piston. It's a double-sided piston that is sealed inside of one cylinder with gas chambers on both sides, and it just flies from one side to the other with only basically a gas seal on each side and an electric generator built over the middle of it so that it can take energy out of it each time the piston goes from one side to the other.
That sounds identical to what I described in an email a week ago that I was saying that Ford and Volvo and Sandia Laboratories are working on.
Okay, so
a
similar conventional technology that can derive its power takeoff that way is known as the, I think it's called the HDDI. I'm forgetting what the acronym is right now, but it's basically a different type of diesel where it's a distributed, where it's a, there's an inlet with the fuel and the air mixture, and yet it still operates like a diesel, but it has controlled ignition.
Now, in this case that you're describing, the output is not torque, but is electricity.
That's right, and I know that's been developed by Sandia for many years.
Mm-hmm.
We're very well familiar with similar technologies.
You have a separate patent on this wrapped
applied
up?
Applied specifically to the PAP. Pulse plasma discharge process.
Pulse plasma discharge.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what you mean by that.
It is a plasma event, but it's not a steady state process, sort of like what's being attempted with the hot fusion tokamak. That's a steady state process that they're attempting to make steady. This is just intended to be a flash, and that's it. It goes to high temperature, and it decays back down to room temperature very, very quickly. Papp said that's the best way to do his reaction instead of trying to do it with continuous plasma process like the hot fusion people are trying to do to mimic the sun. Pap says, I do it just with this pulse discharge and can obtain millions of degrees temperature in the plasma. But the science community says, oh, you're stretching it too far, Joseph. We don't believe you. But that's what Pap said.
Mm-hmm. A million degrees that last a nanosecond dissipated over a second is not going to heat up the surroundings.
If the heat pulse is large enough, it certainly could. But unlike an internal combustion engine where the flame propagates throughout the entire cylinder, the hot spot in the PAP cylinder only remains at the center, away from the walls. So there's no conduction to speak of in that.
I would think radiant
factors. Yes, there's some of that too, but we're not sure of all of the factors that are there because there's also reflection from polished cylinder walls.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't get dirty in there with combustion products. So there's a lot to be figured out yet.
Now, when Rosen was involved with PAP, did he have occasion to put his hand on the engine while it was running and feel it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, the engineer who got TRW involved was over at Roser's shop many, many times. His name is Cecil Baumgartner, and he's still alive and well in the Los Angeles area. He's in his mid-80s and moving slow, but his mind is still in good shape, and I talk with him periodically. And he says, oh, yeah, I put my hand on it, and it was warm, but it was never hot.
How many people who were involved with Joseph Papp while he was alive are still around and accessible?
Oh, less than 10.
And when I say accessible, there were those four groups that are somewhat competitors in the technology. Would each one of those four have access to 10, or would there be some politics that would partition those 10 into only being available to a subset?
Well, Heinz Klostrom has talked with all of them, and all of them individually are willing to cooperate on some level. But amongst them, they may not be willing to come in and work together as a team completely.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Jake and Jimmy Sabori are not cooperating in recent years.
Well, it looks like we are. I'm out of time. I got away from you here.
Yeah.
I appreciate you joining us. It's been a very fascinating interview. And again, you can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. We do have a page about the Joseph Papp technology at peswiki.com. Thanks for joining us, Ken.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.